Hello, and thank you for joining the American Revolution. Today, Episode 80, The Knox Expedition. So the last couple of weeks, we've been discussing Generals Richard Montgomery and Benedict Arnold's attempts to take Quebec. Meanwhile, George Washington remained outside of Boston, mostly watching and waiting for an opportunity to do something. Washington was always restless and looking for a way to break the siege. He sought and received approval from the Continental Congress to bombard and destroy Boston if he deemed it a military necessity. Now, this was no small concession from Congress. The President of Congress, John Hancock, stood to lose his mansion and most of his other property in Boston if this happened. Washington also engaged in many small raids against the regulars. On January 6th, he sent 200 men under the command of Major Thomas Knowlton to raid the Charlestown Peninsula, where the British still occupied Bunker Hill. The purpose of this nighttime raid was to burn 14 houses that could be of use to the enemy. The Continental Raiding Party shot one sentry, which immediately caused the British to fire blindly in their direction. The party ignored the shots from Bunker Hill, set the houses on fire, captured five other regulars, and retreated back across the neck to Cambridge. Now, the main reason anyone remembers this minor raid was that the top military brass in Boston were enjoying a play written by General Burgoyne called The Blockade of Boston, performed by their fellow officers. During the play, a soldier rushed on stage to call on everyone to turn out because the rebels were attacking. The audience simply laughed and assumed it was part of the play. It took a few minutes to convince everyone that this was a real attack. All the officers had to scramble out of the theater and rush to their regiments. Of course, by the time they were ready to go, the raid was over and the Continentals had returned to their lines. Now, raids were one thing, but if Washington ever hoped to take Boston, he would need more artillery. Not just small field pieces, but large cannons and mortars that could take down walls and fortifications and destroy Navy ships. Way back in the spring of 1775, Benedict Arnold and Ethan Allen had taken Fort Ticonderoga and several other forts along Lake Champlain in New York, providing the Patriots with about 200 pieces of artillery. Since that time, though, most of the weapons continued to sit unused at Fort Ticonderoga. At first, Congress wanted to hold those weapons to give them back to the British once this misunderstanding had been resolved. Then, New York did not want to let the weapons go to New England. But with the creation of the Continental Army and the realization that this really was a long-term fight, these initial concerns had faded. By fall, Washington decided that he needed these weapons for use against Boston. Getting them there would not be easy, though. Some of these cannons weighed over 5,000 pounds. Dragging them across rivers and over mountains was going to be hard work. The man Washington chose for the job was not an obvious choice. I introduced Henry Knox back in episode 73, when General Washington appointed him as the new commander of artillery in November 1775. As commander of artillery, Knox's first mission was to find some artillery to command. Washington ordered Knox to go to Ticonderoga and bring back the cannon. Knox always seemed to me like a really improbable choice. The guy was 25 years old, overweight, missing a couple of fingers on one hand from a shooting accident, and had never served in combat. He had dropped out of school at age 9 because his father's business had failed. His father left the family and took off for the West Indies, never to be seen again. As a young adult, Henry Knox had run a bookstore in Boston, which had been a popular hangout for British officers during the occupation. He had also just married the daughter of a prominent Tory. Lucy Flucker Knox was the daughter of Thomas Flucker, the Royal Secretary of Massachusetts. Now, I've heard the last name pronounced Flucker or Fluker, and I'm not sure which is correct, but I really hope it's Flucker, only because I think it would be really hilarious if Knox could refer to his mother-in-law as Mother Flucker. Now, you may recall back in 1774, the Massachusetts Assembly met to select delegates to the First Continental Congress. Governor Gage sent a messenger to the Assembly, ordering them to dissolve immediately. The Assembly locked the doors and proceeded to appoint a delegation, while the governor's representative was banging on the door, demanding that they stop what they were doing. The guy banging on that door was none other than Thomas Flucker. As a royal official, Flucker remained a staunch and prominent Tory in Massachusetts. For many years, he had served on the governor's council. His son was a regular officer in the British Army. Flucker not only objected to his daughter's relationship with Knox based on Knox's patriot leanings, but also because he was a nobody shopkeeper. He was not even a very successful shopkeeper. Knox's business struggled under trade restrictions, making it more difficult and expensive to import British books. The Boston Port Act, ending all trade with Boston, pretty much killed his business entirely. Flucker thought his attractive daughter could snag a British officer, perhaps even an aristocrat. He did everything he could to dissuade Lucy from continuing a relationship with Knox. Lucy was only 17 at the time she wanted to marry the 24-year-old Knox. Her father pointed out that this marriage meant that she would likely be a poor working-class wife, separated socially from her sisters and others in the family. But you know how kids are. Henry and Lucy continued their relationship in secret until Lucy finally convinced her father to allow the marriage. Despite his personal misgivings and arguing that she was making a terrible mistake, Flucker gave his daughter's hand in marriage to Knox in the summer of 1774. He even arranged for Knox to get a commission in the British Army as a captain, an offer that Knox politely refused. Despite his Tory family connections and lack of experience, Knox did have a few things going for him that justified Washington's appointment. Knox, of course, was a member of the Sons of Liberty and an outspoken patriot. Growing up, he had been a member of Boston's South Side Gang, which engaged in the annual Pope's Day riots. He was a street rat who knew how to fight. At the same time, as an apprentice in a bookstore, he had also learned how to cultivate customers and behave in polite society. Knox was at the center of several key pre-war events. He had been a prominent witness at the Boston Massacre in 1770. Witnesses testified that he had tried to calm the Patriot rioters, as well as trying to keep the regulars from firing. There was also good evidence that Knox was one of the Indians who dumped tea into Boston Harbor in 1773. Knox served as a militia officer in Boston's artillery company. He carried a great many military books in his store and studied these books carefully, so at least on paper, he seemed to have a good knowledge of military strategy and tactics. At one point, the British had asked Paul Revere to spy on Knox, not yet realizing that Revere was also a patriot. The two men would meet in Knox's bookstore and have fake arguments in front of British officers to keep up the guise that the two friends hated each other. After Lexington, Knox and his new wife slipped out of Boston. Knox did not join the Patriot Army with a formal enlistment or commission. Rather, he served as a sort of civilian advisor, helping with the defenses around Roxbury. I'm still not clear if he had any role in the Battle of Bunker Hill. Some sources indicate that he directed some cannon fire for the Patriots, but it does not sound like he was even on the Charlestown Peninsula during the battle. If he did anything, it was from a distance, and he still had no formal military commission. When Washington arrived, Knox apparently impressed the new commander with his book knowledge of artillery and military strategy. The two men dined together on several occasions, sometimes with Lucy present as well. Perhaps the fact that both men were Freemasons may have helped. Knox's young and attractive wife apparently got along well with Washington, who had a weakness for flirting with young ladies. Knox was also well-connected. He was good friends with General Nathanael Greene, as well as John Adams and a number of other influential patriots. They all endorsed Knox as a competent and dedicated patriot. The prior military commander, Richard Gridley, was in his mid-60s. He had done a mediocre job at Bunker Hill and did not really seem interested in continuing in this role. Citing illness, Washington was determined to replace him. Gridley would stay on as chief engineer, but would give up his role as commander of artillery. Gridley's second-in-command even endorsed Knox to be the new commander. So there seemed to be a consensus that convinced Washington to go ahead and appoint Knox as the new commander of artillery. Knox's commission was just the sort of thing that drove experienced combat officers nuts. While officers like Benedict Arnold were off fighting real battles, guys like Knox were hanging around with important people back where it was safe and brown-nosing top military officials and political leaders with talk backed by zero military experience. If Knox had failed as an officer, it would have been easy to see why. But as we'll soon see, Knox not only talked the talk, he could also walk the walk. And he proved himself to be a highly capable officer. So, in November of 1775, under Washington's orders, Henry Knox set out in search of cannon. He was not yet officially commissioned as an officer, as that would require an act of Congress, but little things like that did not seem to bother anyone. Washington gave him a command and $1,000 to collect artillery for use against Boston. Knox first set out for New York City, where he met with former Patriot agitator and now militia colonel Alexander McDougall. Knox tried to acquire some of the New York artillery for use in Boston. McDougall offered a few smaller pieces, but was unwilling to part with the larger guns that he wanted to use in New York against the British in the harbor. Knox then set out for Ticonderoga to collect what he could get there. As I said, the Patriots had captured about 200 pieces when they took Ticonderoga and the surrounding forts. But probably only half of those weapons were serviceable, and some of the serviceable ones were now in use by Montgomery and Arnold in their attempt to take Quebec. That whole invasion was still the focus of everyone's attention in December, so Knox had to pick from among what was left at the fort. On his way out to Ticonderoga, Knox spent a night in the home with a British prisoner of war named Lieutenant John Andre, who Montgomery had captured at Fort St. John a few weeks earlier. The men apparently had an enjoyable conversation, and under other circumstances probably would have led to a good relationship. Knox did not discuss the details of his mission with Andre, but the two Freemasons had an enjoyable night together. Years later, of course, General Knox would head the court-martial that condemned Major Andre to death. Based on a letter from Washington, General Schuyler handed over all the Ticonderoga artillery to Knox, still a civilian, to carry back to Cambridge. From the inventory, Knox selected 59 pieces, 43 heavy cannon, 6 coehorns, 8 mortars, and 2 howitzers. In total, he had about 60 tons worth of weaponry to drag back to Boston. And the largest pieces, as I said, weighed as much as 5,000 pounds. Knox optimistically thought he could drag all this equipment 300 miles across lakes, over mountains, in a little more than 2 weeks. But it would not be that easy. In early December, he set out on the first leg, moving the guns by boat down Lake Champlain to Fort George. One of the boats commanded by his brother hit a rock and sank. Fortunately, all the men survived and the equipment was salvaged. But just getting the equipment to Fort George took until December 15th. By that time, the temperature had fallen below freezing. Knox would not attempt to use boats to move the guns down the Hudson River. Instead, he would use sleds to carry the guns along the banks of the Hudson, over the ice and snow to below Albany, then across Massachusetts. There were two problems with that plan. He had no sleds, and there was no ice and snow. December 1775 in inland New York was unusually warm and dry, without enough snow to pull the sleds overland. By Christmas Eve, the region finally had a decent snowfall, but the party still did not have enough sleds. Back in Albany, General Schuyler had fired the military contractor who was building the sleds because the contractor wanted too much money. Somehow, they found other local carpenters to build the sleds, assembling 42 sleds to carry the guns. Knox's team then had to scour the area for animals and teamsters to drive the sleds. Knox had hoped to use oxen to pull the heavy equipment, but could not find enough of them. He would have to use horses. Knox continued to have problems with the weather. By January, there was snow, but too much snow. Drifts of 2 to 3 feet made it impossible for the horses to make much headway. Some days, they could only travel a few miles. They hit additional problems with river crossings. Their route would require crossing the Hudson River multiple times. Although it was freezing, it had not been cold long enough for a thick layer of ice to form over the rivers that they needed to cross. The ice simply still was not thick enough to hold the heavy sleds. The men tried to thicken the ice by drilling holes in it. This forced water, which was under pressure below the ice, to flow up over the existing ice and freeze. This method worked, but was time-consuming and further slowed the progress. As the train progressed, Knox decided to leave the men on their own. Knox was not a hardened military officer. He enjoyed good company in a warm home rather than sitting in a cold, miserable tent at night. He had his men continued on their own and rode off to spend an evening with General Schuyler. While having dinner with Schuyler, a messenger reported that one of the largest cannon had broken through the ice and was sitting at the bottom of the Hudson River near Albany, New York. Knox realized he could not delegate his leadership. He rejoined the train, directly supervising the movement of the remaining guns across the river. Rather than abandon the lost cannon, Knox recruited locals from Albany to recover the gun. There are not a lot of specifics about how they did it, but somehow they got ropes around the drowned cannon and pulled it out of the river onto a new sled. And thanks to the people of Albany, Knox christened the cannon the Albany, a name it would use for the remainder of its service in the war. After this incident, Knox stayed with the train for most of the rest of the journey to ensure no more problems. This probably meant harder going for him, as he did not spend much time visiting with people along the way. Unfortunately, it also meant that he gave up on his regular diary entries, meaning that we know a lot less about this final leg of the journey across Massachusetts. But the team managed to get the guns over the mountains of western Massachusetts. Knox made no attempt to keep his mission a secret. Instead, he showed off his weapons to interested local crowds in the towns and villages he passed along the way. Friendly locals often provided food and shelter for his men as they made the difficult journey. At Westfield, he reportedly fired one of the larger guns to impress the locals. He hit his next challenge at Springfield when the train reached the Connecticut River. The New Yorkers that he had hired to bring the guns that far were exhausted and wanted to go home. They had only agreed to go as far as Springfield and were ready to be done. It had gotten warm again, and most of the snow melted, so the sleds would not work. Knox had to pay off his men and wait for the weather to change again. A few days later, it did, and now that they were in central Massachusetts, there were plenty of friendly locals willing to help continue the mission. Knox was able to hire a new crew of Massachusetts men, along with new teams of oxen, to carry the guns the rest of the way. As the train got closer to Cambridge, Knox once again abandoned his team and rode ahead. By now, at least, they had passed over all the most difficult hurdles. He arrived in Cambridge on January 24, 1776, to inform Washington that the guns would arrive in a few days. He also learned that Congress had granted him his commission as colonel in the Continental Army. I guess that's good, since it would have been a shame if they had denied it, and he would have had to carry all those cannons back to Ticonderoga. But fortunately, that was not a problem. The next day, the train arrived in Framingham. There, John Adams and Elbridge Gerry inspected the guns, along with other locals excited to see the new force of artillery that would soon be pointed at the regulars in Boston. A few days later, on January 27th, the Noble Train, as Knox had called it, arrived in Cambridge, making Knox the toast of the army. Knox had proven himself a capable leader of men, not yet in combat, but at least as a logistical officer. It had taken him nearly 6 weeks to get the artillery back to Cambridge, far longer than the 2.5 that he had planned. Even so, everyone hailed the mission as a great success. He even brought in the expedition under budget and could return some of the advance money he took for the mission. On February 1st, he and Lucy dined with George and Martha Washington. Martha had joined her husband in Cambridge a few weeks earlier. Martha and Lucy would go on to become close friends as their husbands worked together over the next few years in the fight for liberty. Over the next few weeks, Colonel Knox would oversee the deployment of his new guns in Roxbury and other areas around Boston. He would also take command of the artillery regiment. Knox was also pleased to learn that while he was away, the Patriots had captured the British ship Nancy, which included a stash of arms, including over 3,000 cannonballs. Now, in addition to the guns, the Patriots had some ammunition as well. Now, if they could only find enough gunpowder, they would be in business. Next week, a radical immigrant named Thomas Paine finally convinces America that American independence is just common sense. Hi, welcome back to another American Revolution Podcast book recommendation. Before I get to this week's recommendation, I just wanted to note that with today's episode, I've been publishing The American Revolution for a full 18 months, a year and a half. In that time, the podcast's popularity has exceeded my wildest expectations. We have over 150,000 downloads now. There are listeners in all 50 states and over 100 countries around the world. It's probably no surprise that the largest states by population have the largest number of downloads, so California is our biggest audience by state. Just for fun, though, I created a spreadsheet to look at downloads per state divided by the state's population size. Yes, I am boring enough to spend my weekends doing stuff like that. So when adjusted for population, the podcast is most popular in Maryland, followed by Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and surprisingly, Utah. Although over 90% of all downloads are in the U.S., I was particularly surprised at the international interest for this podcast. After all, this is about an event in American history. We have listeners in all but one Canadian provinces. I'm looking at you, Saskatchewan. For those of you wondering, the non-English-speaking country where the podcast is most popular is Norway. I have no idea why this is, but thanks to all my listeners in Norway, and I hope you continue to enjoy. And thanks to everyone who supports this indie podcast. I'm just glad to find that there are others out there who want to learn more about what I consider a very important part of history. Okay. So today's episode was all about introducing Henry Knox and his first major contribution to the cause of the Continental Army. We will see in a few weeks how those cannons are the key to ending the Siege of Boston. Of course, Knox will go on to serve Washington as one of his most valuable generals through the rest of the war. Knox actually takes over for Washington after Washington's resignation at the end of the war in 1783. And of course, Knox will go on to serve as President Washington's first Secretary of War. So this really is the beginning of a beautiful friendship. So it should be no surprise that today's book recommendation is a biography of Henry Knox. There are several good ones out there, but I've chosen Henry Knox, Visionary General of the American Revolution by Mark Pulls. This book, first published in 2008, covers Knox's entire life. I think the writing is good and engaging, and at just over 250 pages of text, it is rather concise to describe a whole lifetime. Now, the author, Mr. Pulls, got his start in journalism with the Detroit News. He also wrote several other books, including an award-winning biography of another American Revolution icon, Samuel Adams. Sadly, Mr. Pulls passed away in 2013. But if you're interested in learning more about Henry Knox, one of Washington's key generals and the first Secretary of War, I can strongly recommend this book. Well, that's all for this week. I hope you will join me next week for another American Revolution podcast.